It's 2003, and the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension is reopening a cold case.
Currently, we're running what we call a flatline of crime.
Two agents bring a man named Dale Todd in for questioning about a death they believe was a murder. It happened nearly 25 years ago in Wright County, Minnesota.
If you refresh my memory,
yeah, we'll do that.
Okay.
They start asking Dale about Jeffrey Hamill, who was found dead by the side of the road in 1979.
You didn't know him, right? Well, I knew him from work.
Okay. Dale Todd was already interviewed about this in 1979. Because he and a couple of friends gave Jeffrey Hamill a ride that night. But he swore then and swears now that's the last they saw him.
I swear to you, on a stack of lies, I did not touch Jeff at all. And I don't know who did.
I filed a records request to get the video of this interview. It was copied over from VHS tapes, and it's hard to hear in some parts. What you just heard was about an hour and a half in. Here's Dale Todd again, 4.5 hours in.
That's when I start getting all these bits and pieces. I see Terry hitting somebody, and this guy here had something in his hand. And then when I came back into the car, I'm saying, well, what the hell's going on? And I started laughing.
At the end of the interview, Dale tells the agents science will take over now. He later tells his wife, if these guys did it, I could get charged too. He sounds like he's waiting for someone else to solve the crime. Little does he know that these agents think they just did, and that 5-hour interview was the confession that would put Dale, Terry, and Ron on trial for Jeffrey Hamill's murder. I'm Emily Havoc, and this is Record of Wrong, a podcast about what it takes to be found innocent again after you've been found guilty. Why it's so hard, even if there's new evidence in your case. Whether it's even possible to prove you didn't do something. And the tools the system uses to preserve convictions when people are claiming innocence. When Jeff Hamill's body was found in 1979, law enforcement interviewed dozens of people, including Dale, Terry, and Ron. They combed the scene. No physical evidence could be found. The manner of death was ruled undetermined, and the investigation inconclusive. The case went cold until nearly 25 years later, when Jeffrey Hamill's biological daughter showed up.
It's just something I always wanted to find out, and always wanted to know where I came from, and not that I don't have a wonderful life, because I do, so, but just always something I was curious about.
She was adopted, and she wanted to know what happened to her birth dad. Wright County Chief Deputy Joe Haggerty reopened the case, and that's where the BCA came in with their Spotlight on Crime cold case initiative.
I was shocked then that I was being interviewed again some 24 years later.
You're hearing from Terry Olson. He was questioned again after Dale Todd implicated him. His life would be forever changed by those 5 hours Dale Todd spent talking to the BCA.
Everything had seemingly been taken care of in 79. And in fact, I was very cooperative.
What got the ball rolling was the confluence of some circumstances. You got a young girl who is searching for her biological parents and learns that her father, quote, died in an accident, goes into the county sheriff's office in Wright County, where she encounters a fairly newly elected sheriff who'd been in the department for a long time. It piqued his curiosity, but at a time when there was also corporate funding to help departments like this department investigate cold cases. And those three things happen at the same time.
That's David Schultz. He would become one of Terry Olson's attorneys down the road. Dale had mental health issues and later said in a signed affidavit that he was addicted to painkillers at the time of his interview in 2003. He told the agents 30 minutes into the questioning that he was off his usual medication because he couldn't afford it. Twice later on in the interview, he referenced previous nervous breakdowns. For hours, he tells the agents that he, Terry, and Ron had nothing to do with Jeffrey Hamill's death, but the agents don't believe him.
Your story is significantly different today from what you told the originals.
The agents say maybe you guys were drunk and stoned and you did something to Jeff.
I never touched the guy. I was not that drunk, or I would have known if I was hurt somebody.
The agents tell Dale that witnesses saw a car similar to his on Highway 12 that night. That was true. They also tell him blood and hair were found on a bat in his car. They say they're going to test it and find out if it's Jeff's. That was not true.
We got your car, we got the bat, we got the blood, we got the hair, we got all those things. We got the hockey sticks, we got all those things. My God, the pieces.
Dale keeps saying he's scared. He believes the agents about the bat with the blood. Now we're about 2 hours in.
I'm thinking that I'm being trapped into something that I didn't do. There's no traps here, Dale. There's no traps at all. All we are trained to do is to...
We show you, read the report.
I understand, but I'm confused, I'm scared, and my chest hurts.
One of the agents tells Dale, when you're telling the truth, you speak fluidly. When it's foggy, you bounce around. He asks Dale, why do you think that is?
Because I don't think that was there.
Yeah. Another reason is because you're not telling the truth.
They tell Dale, even if he blacked out, they're sure he remembers bits and pieces.
There's got to be some remembrance of something that happened. We've given you the facts of as we know.
The agents say to Dale, what if Terry confesses and drags you into this? Dale is crying. He says, it's very possible Terry did it. He asks for a break, and the agents say, let's wait. Finally, Dale says,
I think Terry did get in with Jeff that night. And I think Terry did go after him.
He starts telling the story again and adds something else new. He says after Jeff started walking home from the party, Dale, Terry, and Ron went out looking for him on Highway 12 to give him a ride. Just short of 3 hours into the interview, Dale says, I need a cigarette, and he walks out. The agents follow him. There's at least a 7-minute break where the agents may or may not be talking to Dale, and we can't hear them. I know this because I can see video of the empty interview room. Dale comes back in, and something has changed. He says he's starting to see pictures from that night.
Because I'm getting these little pictures in my head. Right. I think it was him and Terry. I remember puking. For some reason, puking comes in my head.
There was no puke found at the scene, so what Dale is saying doesn't really line up with the investigation. He keeps crying. He says he thinks they hit a deer, but he says now he's thinking it could have been Jeff. The agents say,
I think we're pretty sure that Jeffrey was not struck by a vehicle. At least real hard.
Ron comes into his head. He thinks Ron was there.
Well, and that's what we said was going to happen. If you were as drunk as you say you were, but pretty soon all those pieces are going to fit together.
But Dale still doesn't remember Jeff being in the car. Dale keeps answering their questions with, I think so. He finally whispers, I want to be sure.
Tell us what you think is sure, and then we'll work with that. Tell us what you think happened, and then we'll work with the details.
Dale says, I'm not saying they did it. I just can't remember. But I don't want them saying I did it. Dale tells the agents, I could just say what you want me to say. It was Terry and him. He's talking about Ron here. He keeps forgetting his name. Dale says, but I don't think that's justice. The agents say, we don't want that. We're 4 hours in now.
Who killed Jeff Hamill?
Silence. They ask again.
Who killed Jeff Hamill?
Dale whispers, I want to be right. They ask him, who killed Jeff? He points to the picture of Ron.
Who helped kill Jeff Hamill?
He mumbles a response. Terry? I think it was him and Terry, he says. He's still crying.
Neil, you got to know something. You got to know something.
That's the problem. Well, how often have been, anybody?
They tell Dale if he does get charged, things will go better for him if he tells them what happened. Dale starts the story again. This time, he says he's getting more bits and pieces.
I see Terry hitting somebody, and this guy here had something in his hand. And then when I came back into the car, I'm saying, well, what the hell's going on? And I started laughing.
He said Terry told him they just beat up Jeff. Dale tells the agents, in his mind and in his heart, he knows he had nothing to do with Jeff's beating.
In your mind, you know who is responsible for Jeff Hamill's death.
In my mind, I'm thinking Terry and Ron.
The agents are still trying to get him away from saying, I think so.
I guess I don't understand it. You see Terry and Ron assaulting Jeff Hamill, and Terry comes in and says, you beat up Jeff Hamill. And that's where Jeff Hamill is found dead. I guess in my mind, it's Terry and Ron.
Dale says, I think it is Terry and Ron.
Dale, is there any doubt as to the location that this happened, this fight? Maybe there's a little bit of doubt in my mind, yes.
Well,
I'm not trying to get you sidetracked to something else. What I'm saying is, you're saying, can I be absolutely sure? No, I cannot be absolutely sure.
Dale starts saying, if these two did do it, why didn't I stop them? And why didn't they hurt me? He says, if they did it, then I'm guilty of not helping Jeff. He keeps saying if, like he's not sure if they did it. The agents thank him for his honesty. They're trying to wrap up the interview. Dale says something strange.
Science will take over now. Forensics are watched the show all the time, and it's amazing what they can do.
Dale still seems to think that science will help them crack the case. He now thinks there's blood and hair that they can test, but there's no physical evidence. At this point, Dale is all they have. As Dale gets up to leave, he starts talking about his mental health struggles again.
I think I'm going to go see a shrink or something.
That might not be a bad idea.
Because I've been on these pills for quite a long time. And I'm off them now. But I can sort of really feel the stress.
Dale's wife calls him right here, and he answers and talks to her in front of the agents and on camera. He says as soon as they get insurance, he thinks he should go see a therapist. And then he says, if these are the guys who did it, they might throw something at me, because I was there. But Dale still seems to be waiting for them to figure out whether Terry and Ron did it. He doesn't realize that this 5-hour interview will be considered a confession and will form the basis of the entire case against all three men. Dale's comments about puking by the roadside were puzzling, because nothing like that was found at the scene. I talked to Jim Powers, who was the Wright County Chief Deputy back in 1979.
So you were one of the people who responded to that scene, right, when they found his body?
Yes, it must have been 3 o'clock in the morning, somewhere around there. We searched 100 yards each side of that location looking for any kind of weaponry, any kind of indication of vehicle had stopped, any kind of footprint, anything of that nature. And we found nothing.
There were other things Jim Powers found suspicious. There was no indication that Jeff Hamill ran or that he was fighting anybody off. Jim said it looked like Jeff died quickly. No blood on his shirt. And no blood on his hands, indicating he didn't hold them up to cover any of his wounds. Jim Powers said he and the sheriff at that time believed it was a hit and run with a vehicle trailing a large piece of equipment. David Schultz, who ended up representing Terry, said the Dale Todd confession looks different in hindsight than it might have in 2003.
Certainly, things were implanted or told to him that he then said, oh, yeah, I remember this. But it never originated with him. It came from what he was told or what was suggested to him during the interview. This has all the hallmarks of what the research has shown is a false confession.
David Schultz is now a magistrate judge for the District of Minnesota, but years ago he was an attorney who represented Terry Olson through the Great North Innocence Project. I have to say here that everything David tells me in this episode is his own opinion as a former lawyer, not his official opinion as a judge. After the Dale Todd interview, things kind of snowball. The first autopsy report ruled the manner of death inconclusive, but Dale's testimony is used to get a medical examiner to re-rule the death a homicide. She says she thinks the injuries are more consistent with assault than with impact from a car. But years later, she admits in another court hearing that she changed it largely based on Dale Todd's statements, which she called newly discovered evidence. Terry and Ron were indicted on murder charges by a grand jury. Dale Todd got aiding and abetting. Chief Deputy Joe Haggerty talked to Care 11 after the indictment in 2005.
We felt they had a story they put together back in 1979. Unfortunately, people can remember the truth, but not their lies.
Dale Todd was offered a deal by the prosecution. Testify against Ron and Terry in exchange for a lesser charge. Dale agreed. Ron's trial came first. Dale got up on the stand and started telling the last version of the story he had told the BCA agents. But at the end, he broke down. He said, "I didn't do this. We didn't do this." The prosecutor asked him, "Then why did you say you did?" He said, "Because I didn't want to go to jail for something I didn't do." Here's Terry.
And in fact, a quote from his recantation at the first trial was that no one would believe me when I told them the truth. They kept hounding me and hounding me on what they wanted me to say. So I told them the story they gave me. At that point, we all should have went home. We didn't.
The jury acquitted Ron Michaels, but Terry's trial went on as scheduled. Terry says he was offered a plea deal before the trial. He said no. Court documents show that Dale wanted to plead the fifth and not testify at Terry's trial, but he was told he could be held in contempt of court and possibly serve 6 more months in jail. Other court records later revealed that Dale Todd received a visit in jail from Joe Haggerty and one of the BCA agents the night before he testified. He said afterward that he was afraid if he didn't testify, that his plea deal would fall apart, and even that he could be recharged with murder in Jeffrey Hamill's death.
Dale Todd believes somehow that if he tells the truth, it's going to expose him to further criminal prosecution.
He did testify against Terry. Jailhouse informants also testified, saying Terry admitted to the assault while in jail. Innocence advocates frequently point to jailhouse informants as problematic, because the prosecution can offer them deals for their testimony. In Terry's case, though, two additional jailhouse informants actually took the stand and said that he maintained his innocence while in jail. In the end, the jury convicted Terry of Jeff Hamill's murder.
It's hard to find a word that explains what I felt during that trial. It was scary. I think it turned into a situation where someone had to be found guilty in this case, and I was the only one left.
Aside from Dale Todd himself, Terry Olson is maybe the person who was impacted the most by that BCA interview. While Ron Michaels was acquitted and Dale got a lesser charge of aiding an offender to avoid arrest, Terry was convicted of murder and given the heaviest sentence.
You know, people would expect me to hate Dale Todd. It made me cry because at one point in my life, he was my friend. And what they did to him was just as tragic as what they did to myself.
Immediately after the trial, Dale Todd sent a letter to the court recanting his testimony, saying he and Terry were innocent. Dale said he testified the way he did because he was, quote, afraid to go to jail for life for something we did not do. David Schultz wasn't on the case at the time, but he says the judge sent the letter to both attorneys to let them decide how to proceed. Schultz says the defense went to find Dale Todd, but they couldn't get him to talk, so they dropped it. Terry went to prison and filed appeal after appeal, losing every one over more than a decade. David Schultz told me when he came on board in Terry's defense, the team found a new piece of evidence, another recantation from Dale Todd. This one was different.
Well, people knew that Dale Todd had maybe some mental health issues, but what they knew was that he had anxiety and took some medication, or at one time had taken medication for anxiety. They did not have anywhere near the complete picture of the seriousness of his mental illness.
While Dale Todd was acting as the prosecution's star witness, medical records show that he was falling apart behind the scenes. On November 1st, 2006, after he recanted at the Ron Michaels trial, a treatment note from a doctor and nurse who saw him while he was in custody said, "Apparently today in court, things did not go well." The doctor wrote that Dale was having suicidal thoughts and believed he would be charged with first-degree murder. He was hearing voices. He told the doctor he was going to testify that someone was guilty when they were not, so he could get a, quote, good deal. But he said he had to tell the truth. After that, another medical provider evaluated Dale and believed he had psychotic depression. He was not sure if Dale knew right and wrong or what he was saying. The provider recommended a Rule 20 evaluation. That's where the defendant gets a psychological evaluation to determine if they're competent to proceed with the case. He said, at least, Dale Todd needed to be seen by a psychiatrist and get started on some meds. The medical staff talked to Chief Deputy Joe Haggerty and said a counselor had recommended a Rule 20. Haggerty said he'd have to call the DA. He called back and said Todd was not going to get a Rule 20 at this time, as he is a witness. David Schultz found that none of this had been handed over to the defense during the trial. In his appeal, he accused the prosecution of withholding evidence that could benefit the defendant. That appeal was denied in July 2014. Terry had been behind bars for 9 years. Schultz said the judges in these appeals essentially kept ruling that any recantation by Dale Todd was cumulative, meaning it was nothing new. The jury in Terry's case did know that Dale Todd recanted once. What would it matter if he did it again? The way Schultz sees it, it was like the judges were thinking,
you can come in here and talk about Dale Todd all you want, but we all know about Dale Todd. We know he did this, and we know he recanted, and then he recanted the recantation. And so if he did it 3 times or he did it 6 times, it doesn't change anything.
But Schultz believes this recantation was different.
It's a statement made for the purposes of medical treatment. It is entirely voluntary. It is unprompted. It's not made to law enforcement. And he, in the statement, he explains what he just did, why he did it, what the real truth is, and why he's going to lie next time in the future and say they did it. All those things were unique to that statement. It was different from all the other statements. And that was never turned over in discovery. When we got it, we brought a Brady claim.
A Brady claim has to do with the Brady Doctrine, a rule requiring the prosecution to turn over any exculpatory evidence. That's evidence that could help the defense's case. Schultz said he was baffled when the appeals court denied this claim.
At a minimum, you got a guy that goes this way, then that way, then this way, then that way, then this way, then that way, and you know he's mentally ill. Why doesn't the fact that he keeps going like this tell you that the evidence is so unreliable in and of itself that it shouldn't be admitted?
The fight wasn't over. Terry's team filed a petition with the federal courts for a writ of habeas corpus in 2015. In it, they included multiple claims, including a claim of actual innocence. The judge denied part of the petition, but he also asked Terry to resubmit it, getting rid of some of the claims, but keeping the actual innocence claim in there. They had 30 days. For Terry, this was a huge ray of hope, the first in a decade behind bars.
My response when I saw it was very positive, which isn't a level that's hard to get to when everything else has been so negative to that point. So it didn't take much, but I thought it was a huge breakthrough.
David Schultz explained what this said to him as an attorney and what he believes it said to the Wright County prosecutors.
And so what that said to the prosecution is, unlike many, many habeas cases, we're going to reach the merits of this thing. And the merits of this thing couldn't be separated from the innocence claim. That was the merits of it.
The prosecutors were facing the prospect of a federal court deciding whether Terry had enough of a claim of actual innocence to grant a new trial.
That's what they were staring down the barrel of. And they didn't want to have the federal court answer that question. I believe that. They never said that. That's my opinion. But I believe that in my heart of hearts, they didn't want to have a federal court doing that.
Terry's team got to work amending the petition. But then they received a letter. It was from the assistant Wright County attorney, Greg Kreiser. He said the habeas petition had caused his office to review Terry's sentence. They'd like to offer a deal. We've got to back up a little bit here. When Terry was sentenced, it was according to 1979 guidelines. That's the year Hamill died. That's what both the defense and the prosecution agreed upon. Under those guidelines, you're sentenced to a range of time, and the Department of Corrections has discretion to set your exact release date. While Terry and his lawyers, and even the prosecution, expected him to be released in 86 months. But the DOC sentenced him to 204, more than double what everyone expected. Terry's lawyers believe the DOC calculated his criminal history score based on crimes that he was convicted for after 1979, while the case was cold. But in 1979, he had no criminal history. Your criminal history score can make your sentence shorter or longer for the same crime. Terry did have a record, including domestic assault, stalking, and violating an order for protection. Those convictions all happened in the 90s and early 2000s. And I think it's important to note that he has not been convicted of a crime since he got out of prison in 2016. I asked the Department of Corrections why they gave Terry such a long sentence. And they sent me a statement saying that the 1979 guidelines provide for a departure from the normal release date matrix when the crime involves great bodily harm. But the Wright County Attorney's Office wrote David Schultz a letter offering to release Terry immediately since he'd already served 130 months. They said this was, quote, 4 years longer than Mr. Olson would have most likely received under the 1979 parole matrix. But this deal was not an exoneration. It would be a resentencing. Wright County was admitting no wrongdoing. They were maintaining Terry's guilt, and he would have to give up his appeal.
You can have your freedom, or you can continue to fight to clear your name. If you want your freedom, you're going to have to give up your fight to clear your name.
The very first thing on my mind was my mother, who'd been ill since 1998 with a stroke, in a wheelchair, in assisted living. And her health was bad at the time. And the one thing I did not want to happen in this was for my mother to pass away while her son was still in prison.
David Schultz and Julie Jonas, both Innocence Project lawyers, talked Terry through the offer.
You know, we laid out, if you do this, this is what's going to happen, right? You're not going to be able to sue for civil liability. You're not going to be able to have a piece of paper that says you are innocent, but you'll be out of prison in time to for sure see your mom. If you go this way, we don't know for sure what the result will be. Even if you have a good result at the trial court level in federal court, that can be reversed on appeal to the Eighth Circuit should they choose to appeal it. The one thing we can tell you is it's going to take several years from now until that process is done. And then, frankly, we said two other things. Number one, nobody can make this decision but you, Terry. It is fundamentally personal, and we will never second guess your decision or criticize whatever decision you make. He asked us what we would do personally, and both Julie and I said we would take it.
Terry didn't buy that the Wright County attorney was suddenly realizing there was a problem with the sentence. That's because Terry had brought the sentencing problem up on appeal 6 years ago.
That was a very confusing time for me. Did I want out of prison? You bet I did. But I did not want out of prison that way. I'd already spent 11 years in prison for something that I didn't do. And I always felt that somehow the justice system would see through all this.
Terry took the deal. He says one reason was to see his mother. The other was that he had lost faith.
If you don't sign it, what did I have to face? Years and years of appeals?
He's been out of prison for nearly 5 years. His mother has pulled through so far, but she's still unwell. He visits her in assisted living now. His first year out, he says he had terrible anxiety attacks. He would shake violently and cry like a little kid. He couldn't get his driver's license back for 6 months. He couldn't find an apartment for a year. He's now 62 years old and feels haunted by the conviction for this crime.
I'm not in prison anymore, but yet I feel like I'm still in prison. I'm in my own apartment. My space is bigger. I have my own shower and I can walk to my own fridge. Nobody's outside my door, patrolling where I live or making sure I'm doing what I should be doing or what they feel I should be doing. But I'm still trapped. I'm just in a bigger space.
Terry told me his life feels stagnant. He lost his job and can't find another one. He says he can't even get past the recruiters. He has trouble being in crowds and wonders if people recognize him. It's hard to build relationships with a murder conviction on his record. He wonders what people are thinking of him, what they aren't saying.
Some, of course, do understand. Some don't. Some have questions after questions, and even if you give them the right answers, they still have those doubts in their minds. And I can see that in people's faces and in their eyes.
I reached out to the Wright County Attorney's Office asking if anyone would talk to me about Terry's case. Both Assistant County Attorney Greg Kreiser and former County Attorney Tom Kelly, who just retired, declined an interview. Kreiser sent me a statement from Tom Kelly saying in part, "Mr. Olson's guilt has never been called into question. Every court that has reviewed this conviction over the past 10 years has agreed on one thing. Mr. Olson is a convicted murderer. Mr. Olson has never been exonerated for killing Mr. Hamill." The statement references overwhelming evidence against Terry and the fact that he repeatedly admitted his guilt to other inmates while awaiting trial. Those are the jailhouse informants we talked about earlier. The county attorney said his office only agreed to shorten the sentence as, quote, "a matter of fairness and justice." Terry continued to fight in court for a while with another attorney, Erica Holzer, who tried to take his case to the United States Supreme Court. Under the law in Minnesota, Terry can't seek federal habeas relief for violations of his civil rights by the Department of Corrections because he's no longer incarcerated. And he can't seek relief under a different federal statute, Section 1983, unless he can prove favorable termination, like an exoneration. So because Terry took a deal, he lost his ability to even get in the door to try to make his case that his rights were violated. He and Erica wanted to change this. They argued that the deal Terry signed was no deal at all. In fact, that it shouldn't even be considered a voluntary agreement.
You know, Terry agreed to forgo his claims against the county and the prosecuting authority in exchange for his freedom. And our position was that that is not an enforceable contract. The law provides, and this is common law back to England, that any contract entered into under duress. So the classic example is somebody's got a gun to your head and they say, okay, sign this contract. The law recognizes that that is not a contract entered into freely. And so the contract terms are therefore void. So a lot of these folks who enter these deals, they get their freedom in exchange for whatever they agreed to. And it's typically their agreement to not sue the prosecutor or the county or state who is responsible for their incarceration in the first place. And our position is that those agreements not to sue are invalid, and that the folks who are, in most cases, agreeing to those plea deals are doing so essentially under duress, under a veil of coercion, such that the terms of those agreements are unenforceable.
The Supreme Court declined to review their petition at the end of last year. That was Terry's last shot at legal relief.
So I'm the keeper of hope when it comes to Terry. His case has been a beacon of light in my practice of law, just because so many of these cases don't end the way that Terry's did, with freedom. So I'm holding on to hope that there's some relief down the road for Terry. What that looks like, I don't know. There is a pardon process that we're looking into. I hope that Terry can find relief in other ways, being able to tell his story freely and bringing awareness to this issue. So this is not the end of the story for Terry, but it is the end of his legal claims against the state for his wrongful incarceration.
It eats away at Terry sometimes that he feels the men who took his life away got to keep living theirs unimpeded. Joe Haggerty became sheriff and then retired in 2019. Wright County Attorney Tom Kelly retired at the end of 2020.
They get to, spend their lives sitting on the lakeshore, fishing and hunting and doing all the things I should have been doing. I won't be able to do that. I'm okay with just being okay now. That's a hard thing to say. It's a hard way to live.
And what happened to Dale Todd? He ended up pleading guilty to a lesser felony charge, aiding an offender to avoid arrest. He served just over 3 years in prison. He's never been convicted of another crime in Minnesota. Terry is not the only one who feels the impact of his conviction and time in prison everywhere he goes. For people who were wrongfully convicted decades ago, the system was even less forgiving than it is now. Next time on Record of Wrong.
He kept telling us he didn't do it.
His biggest conversation is, I'm a good boy. It's just like when you hear about somebody being abused.
What happened at each point, the same errors were perpetuated. At each point, nobody took the time to dig a little bit deeper and see what was really going on.
And that's all you know to say. I'm a good boy.
Did you ever work another case like this?
No, this was one of a kind.
Being a born-again Christian and everything, the truth is all I know that can set a person free. All this other stuff, I don't believe in it.
This is Record of Wrong, a Care 11 original podcast. Check out recordofwrong.com for more information about the cases we cover. Record of Wrong is reported and produced by me, Emily Havoc, with editor Rita Butero. Original music is by Dave Mailing and me. Dave Mailing also did our mixing and mastering. Original artwork by David Malman. Special thanks to Lauren Olson, Janine Vogelar, and other Care 11 management and staff for their contributions, and to the people who shared their stories with us.